You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hello there and welcome to the show. My God, it's episode 70. 70. 70? 70. 10 points to the first person to tell me via Twitter, at ComComPod, which British comic has a routine that involves him saying 70 a lot. 70? I've not crossed paths with him in ages, bless him. When I say 10 points, remember what a points mean? Nothing. Nonetheless, this is episode 70, and it's a man who describes himself variously as the punmeister, the pun finder, the man with the golden pun, the pun finder general. I don't know, I'm sure there are lots of them. But as you'll hear, there is a great deal more to his comedy than simply his excellent wordplay. It's Tim Vine.
Hi, Tim.
How are you?
Thank you very much. I'm very well. How are you?
Very well. Yeah, I've got to stop going. Yeah. It's not a comedy show.
That's it. We've just
no
been
hand signals.
As you came in, we were just debating the relative merits of this being a comedy show and the fact that most of my guests, at some point 20 or 25 minutes into the show, kind of look up and go, is this all right? Because no one's laughing at them.
Yeah, that's kicked in a bit earlier.
They're not
me.
Used to it. Yeah, that's okay. That's all right. We could deal with that. So, Tim, you were saying you've just come off stage from your chat show.
Yes, I'm doing a thing called the Tim Vine Chat Show where I when people arrive, there are forms on the table saying, if you want to be interviewed, fill these in. And I choose five people from the audience and I talk to them. And if that's funny, then great. If not, I crowbar a few of my jokes in en route.
Sure. It's a fantastic format. It was. I want to talk a bit more about it in a little
while. You should work in television.
But is it a conscious TV pitch? I mean, you've done it. This is the second year.
No, I've given up on that. I've been doing it for about 4 years. I think it's not going to be on television, I don't think. At least I don't know. But it's probably a bit too simple in a way because the times I've been to meetings and talked about it, people go, it feels like part of a show.
Yes. Okay. Yeah,
but
okay.
No one likes a simple idea, do they?
No, no. But I'm really impressed by the elegance of the concept, which is that you interview the man in the street. You interview people from the audience.
Yeah. Well, you know, it came about by accident actually, because I sort of felt like I'm when I do my stand up, it's very tightly scripted, doing kind of one liners and stuff. But I always felt like whenever I did stray off script a bit and doing gigs and stuff, I always thought I think I'm reasonably good at this sort of the ad libbing thing. But I never had. There was never really much chance to do it. So I thought maybe if I do a chat show, I could, you know, do all that. So I wanted to do a chat show and I thought Edinburgh would be a good place to do it. So I decided to do a preview near where I lived. And then I sort of, as the day approached, I realised I hadn't booked any acts. We sort of left it too late. So I said to the guy who was working with me on it, a guy called Jobbins, I said, look, why don't we just, I'll bring people out of the audience and I'll interview them and we'll get an idea.
Okay.
And then it went so well using people from the audience. You know, well, why don't we just do that, you know, so.
That's great. Well, I think that's a lovely. That's the definition of the word organic in terms of a process, isn't it?
I suppose so. Yeah, or accidental, maybe.
Yeah. So we'll talk about a bit more about the chat show later on. But just to give a grounding, I'm sure everyone here knows who you are. Everyone
don't
listening.
Don't say that. The heads start shaking. No, he's off. Look, this guy. No idea. Yeah.
But you're a magician. Widely known Nazi. Magician. Yeah. You're a widely known joke smith. You are one of the one-liner guys. There's sort of you, Milton Jones, Gary Delaney, but you are absolutely recognised as a... Would you say you're a household name, do you think?
No. No, I would never say that, no. Domestos, that's a household name. No, I, I, No, I'm always genuinely surprised if some, you know, if people say, "Oh, you're that bloke," you know.
Really?
So, yeah. So I don't consider myself a household name.
Okay.
No. Yeah.
Well, I want to just kind of put you in some context by asking you how you started comedy.
I've always
comedy
wanted someone to put me in context.
Well, it's going to happen now, Tim. It's going to happen now. Because I saw, actually, on one of your DVDs, you'd included tiny little clips, like sort of a clip of one joke at a time, of Tim Vine through the ages. Of you gigging in different situations and with varying amounts of hair.
Yes, exactly. I mean, only going in one direction, sadly. Yeah.
So when you first started, what was your impetus to get on stage? What was your...
Well, I suppose I always wanted to do it when I was younger, but not necessarily comedy. I always wanted to do something on stage, I think. I used to want to do puppet shows very early on when I was about 10. In fact, I did these little puppet shows and things, and I was very into the Muppets. I went through a period of doing... I did a few children's parties when I was about 11 or 12 or something. I think I only did two or three.
Okay.
It was vaguely connected
with the puppet show?
Yeah, but it was like vaguely connected. It wasn't like advertised in a newspaper or anything like that. It was something like, you know, friends of my mum or something who said, oh, my daughter's have a birthday. Oh, Tim will come and set up this big thing. And I did, I did Cinderella with puppets or something. And then when I was at school, I wrote little plays and things. And gave myself the leading role, and then used to put those on. I remember putting one of those onto the school, and then it was sort of the thing that surprised me about it was the time. I thought I'd written this quite a long. It was Jason and the Argonauts. I thought I'd written this epic piece. I'd never actually timed it, so when we did it in front of the school, it was over in like 9 minutes.
Okay.
So I thought, but that's taken up so many pages. How come it's so short? So. Anyway, so I did that. And then I wanted, in my 20s, I wanted to be a pop star. And then I used to write loads of songs and things. And then I just discovered the... I didn't discover it, not like Columbus.
you created stand-up comedy.
I'm sure you've interviewed so many comics about stand-up. I'm sure that they would all say that it's something very, very... It's a very magical time when you first discover all these clubs.
Yeah.
You start doing all these open spots, and for me, I never thought about doing it as a job. I became obsessed about about doing longer. You know, I would see people. It's funny, I just bumped into Alan Davis. I will name check him now, but people like Alan and Eddie Izzard and Bill Bailey and the Rubber Bishops, these people doing 20 minutes. There's this golden thing of 20. Imagine staying on stage for 20 minutes. And it not feeling too long,
yeah.
You know. So I used to go to when I was doing these open spots, 5 minute open spots. I see people doing 20 minutes, and I think, yeah, I'd love to. And I remember my first 20 minutes in a pub in Soho called the Crown and Two Chairmen, and being given £50 at the end of it. And I just thought, God, that's unbelievable.
So when you've always been a one liner guy, have you, or were you?
No, not really. No, initially the very first time I tried any stand up was at a place called the Comedy Cafe in London, and it was. They used to have a competition night on Wednesday nights, and you put your name on a list. 12 acts did 5 minutes each, and then the winner got £25.
I think they still do that now without the prize money.
Do they? I think they possibly do it without the comedy as well, actually. So I used to go along every Wednesday. I was working in an office in Croydon at the time, and I used to go every Wednesday. I'd get on the train and go there. Initially, the security guard was a friend of mine at Croydon. He used to come with me initially, and then after about 3 weeks, he sort of dropped out, and I just kept going and going and going. And I've forgotten.
Yeah, we were talking about the type of stuff you were doing. You're saying,
oh yeah,
so
I did all sorts of different things. The very first time I got on stage, I think I tried someone else, and they just groaned at all of them. And I thought, and I actually remember it very distinctly saying to myself, this circuit that I'm on, you can't do that sort of thing. You can't come on and do, you know, Black Beauty, He's a Dark Horse. You can't.
Okay.
That's not the sort of thing they're after.
Sure.
So it's was got that? To be. So I actually thought to myself, right, okay, if I do that, I'm just going to groan at me. This is quite a great rolling laugh of Black Beauty. So I then would try different. I'd do a different 5 minutes each Wednesday. To be honest, sometimes I'd go on. I remember doing a whole thing to do with how I'd accidentally caused the death of various historical characters, which was a bit more chatty, you know. And some of that worked. I'd had a thing where I would say. For example, JFK. I went to JFK's house, and I said, "Can I borrow one of your cars? I'm going on holiday or something." And he said, "Well, I'm going to Dallas." He said, "I've got two cars in the garage. I've got the the convertible or the bulletproof Bentley.
Yeah.
And he said, and I said, well, look, it's gonna, you're going to Dallas on the weekend. It's going to be lovely weather. You have the convertible.
Sure, sure. Okay.
So I had slightly longer things. I didn't, even that feels quite short. But at the time, yeah. I stretched that out. And then I think I was then, through a similar device, I was responsible for, I think, James Dean's death and various, you know. In fact, when I first saw Forrest Gump some years later, I thought they'd taken my idea.
Really? But those were still, those were very kind of joke-driven ideas, weren't they?
I suppose they were,
They weren't, I mean, you weren't, or were you at any stage doing kind of more observational stuff or stuff about yourself or expressing yourself?
Well, I see what you mean. No, I never really spoke as though, you know, saying, hey, I'm from Cheam.
Hey, it worked. It's killing here.
Well, the one time I did any gig in America, I did just 10 minutes at the American Comedy Store, and I was... And every act before me came on and said, hey, I'm from da da da. Mm-hmm. Each one started like that. Mm-hmm. Hey, I'm from West Hollywood, and this is what it's like there. Hey, I'm from da da, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and I came on, I was the only one, the totally different accent. I was the one who didn't start like that, and the only one really who absolutely should have. I just came on and said, so I went to the butcher's. And they stared at me for 10 minutes. They were just transfixed by the fact, you know, but where are you from?
Yeah. When you were making those first kind of gigs, what was the reaction of the people around you? What was the reaction of your family? Were they thinking, "Oh, Tim's found a thing"? Because this is, you know, this is the kid who always did puppet shows. You found a.
Well, I think my dad used to find it very funny. I used to die a lot at open spots and stuff, and I had one of these little dictaphone things that recorded, and at the time. Well, I remember I was living with mum and dad at one point. They're doing that. So I still do, no, I don't. But I remember coming home one time and waking them. It must have been quite late. And I had this dictaphone of me dying, basically. Mm-hmm. And I woke my dad up to play it to him. And he thought it was hilarious. He thought it was so funny. It was because it was basically, you could hear, all you could hear was, yeah, get off, no, like that. And then every now and again, you'd hear my voice just rise up and go, so I went to the library. Yeah. And then it would disappear again. You know? So I think they liked it. But my mum, you know, mums tend to worry more. And I think maybe my mum was worried that, you know, when's he going to get a job? Because I didn't tend to stay in any jobs very long. I always used to sort of mess about in jobs and then leave. And then so I've left that one, you know. And they will say, well, you should have another one lined up before you leave the one you're leaving. So, but I think gradually, now, of course, they're very proud of the fact that, because I don't know when they became proud of it, but I think that's what's happened.
So I just want to stay with that moment of you first discovering it. You know, you said there's a time in every comic's life when they go, oh, my God, this thing exists. So did you feel like you'd found... Did you feel like you'd found your thing? Like, I've kind of faffed around doing all sorts of different performing, acting and street performing and stuff. And when I discovered stand-up, I went, oh, great, at last.
Absolutely, I'd have said it. Honestly, that's exactly what I'd feel like, yeah. I feel as though when I did jobs, I was always messing about. In a way, I was always doing comedy during my jobs. Mm-hmm. You know, I used to, when I was, the last job I had in an office, I used to do things like climb onto the roof during meetings and make animal noises and, like, the sound of sheep and stuff like that. And I was, you know, then I was in my mid-20s. I really should have been doing something by then.
In fact,
a friend of mine said to me, who I used to sit opposite in the office, who I'm still a very good friend of mine, still in touch with now, and he said, and it was a really badly paid job, and he said, do you know what? Even though for the money you get now, for the work you do, you're really well paid. And I couldn't argue with him. I didn't do anything. I just messed about all the time. I wrote a lot because I was doing, often I'd be going and doing open spots in the evening for about a year and a half of when I last had a job. You know, a proper one. Mm-hmm. I'd write, I don't know what the job was I had. It was in an admin department. I never understood what I was doing.
So given that you discovered this, the kind of the one-liner approach. You were saying that you said, like, the Black Beauty
kind of,
joke.
I can tell you as well, that kind of happened quite naturally as well.
Okay.
Because what happened was I started, and like I say, when I started, they groaned at me a lot. So I started trying to find it. And again, it seems like a kind of obvious thing, but unless you've gone through it as when you're doing lots of stand-up, it is the case that you do sort of look for your voice. And literally, you say, well, should I talk... Should I talk like that? Or should I talk like that? Or should I talk like... You literally... And it's... When you discover that you're actually just supposed to talk like you normally talk, it seems like a great revelation. Oh, of course, just use my voice.
But yeah, sure.
But all stand-ups kind of go through that thing. Yeah. Of, you know, should I go like that? Or should I go like this? Again, I don't know what the question was, but it was a fantastic answer to whatever. Yeah. Because I know what I was going to say, yes. Right, so it happened in quite a natural way in that I started with one-liners and they groaned at them. And then I tried all these different things. And then I absolutely distinctly remember there's two moments. One, I was doing an open spot at the Comedy Store and I was doing, I think I may well have been doing the whole thing about causing people's deaths thing. And it was going really, really well. And I thought to myself, I'll chuck in one of these one-liners that I'd written that mm-hmm. I'd since thought this circuit doesn't want. So I said, I went to the doctors. He said, you got hypochondria. I said, not that as well. And it got a real woof, you know. And I had a little moment where I thought, oh, well, maybe you can do these jokes on this circuit. And that, so that was a moment that made me think I'll bring some of those jokes back in again. And the second time was I had a similar sort of epiphanal moment, was at a place called the Bedford in Balham, where yeah. they do, it's a very famous club there. And it was in the main room. I was on the balcony. There was an act called Noel James on. Now, Noel James is yeah. very, very funny,
yeah,
brilliant,
fantastic.
Brilliant Welsh comic who did lots of kind of quirky, surreal, one-linery type things. But he was completely storming it, and he did this joke where he said it's just totally daft. He just said, I saw this bloke going bald. He was going bald, bald, like this. Now, because he was already storming it,
yeah.
this joke, it continued. It was another massive woof. And I looked around the room and I thought, that's utterly silly what he's just done there. Mm. And it's got this big woof of a laugh. And it made me feel like, oh, well, you know, it's all right to be silly. I don't know whether I thought when I first got onto the circuit, because there was a lot of very cool comics that I thought maybe I've got to find some way of, because a lot of the comics I like, the sort of traditional comics from the past, maybe it looked like, because I'm in a way, people have occasionally said, well, it was a bit of a throwback, you know, maybe it's sure. not particularly new, perhaps in the sort of early 90s, to come on and be doing all that kind of jokes that seem like that someone like Tommy Cooper could have told them, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But I realise actually it's sort of amounts to the same thing as the circuit, really. You have to write your own stuff. As long as you write your own stuff, that's one of the main rules. You write your own stuff, and you know, there's one or two obvious sort of boundaries in terms of what you can say, in terms of being sexist or racist and all those sort of things. But other than that, if you write your own stuff and you make them laugh, then the circuit accepts you. And I went back towards the one-liners. But I never ever thought to myself, I'm going to have an act full of one-liners and just go bang, okay. bang, 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 bang. That just kind of evolved through the fact that I realised you could do silly stuff. And also, I don't like waiting too long before the next laugh because I think it makes me nervous. That's my theory anyway.
Okay. So is there? We'll come back. Well, not at all. We'll come back to the momentum in a minute. But do you, just given that you have a fondness for silly stuff, and as you were saying, there were a lot of cool other comics when you started, which are much more when you go and do the Banana Cabaret.
Yeah, and I thought they were cool. Don't get me wrong. I didn't look at them and think, oh, look at the cool comics. Not at all. I wanted to be those people.
Sure.
You know?
And yet you had the honesty to kind of recognise, or for audiences to recognise, that you weren't necessarily cool.
Well, I don't, but no one gets into comedy to be cool. Well, maybe nowadays, maybe they do. I don't know.
I'm just thinking of when you walk up into the Banana Cabaret.
To me, getting a laugh was cool. Trying to be. And to me, to go on and do 20 minutes and just it to be bang, bang, bang all the way through.
Sure,
that to me was cool.
Sure. Well, I think one of your very attractive qualities that I think audiences really respond to is you are very clearly yourself. You're very honestly yourself. And you're being honest about your desire for silliness in an industry where I do think there's an awful lot of kind of the comics that I think of as the sort of the wild-eyed loners.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? They kind of want to go, oh, these are my thoughts, this is my stuff. And actually, it's very refreshing.
I haven't got any thoughts.
Yeah,
stuff.
Well, there we are. But do you think that's part of why audiences go for your stuff?
No, I don't think audiences think through like that. I think
no, but on an instinctive
to,
level,
you either
I
tickle
mean.
Them or you don't. I think at the end of the day,
sure, okay.
But it's probably as simple as that. When they pay money at the door, they want to be made to laugh. And I think that I don't think they go, "Yeah, I like this guy, but I'm laughing because he's not doing what that other guy's doing." I don't
well,
think
they,
like
they
really.
Might not be articulating it, but I think there's something about the way audiences respond to different comics is because it, you know, they, it
yeah,
might
maybe.
Be just as simple as them going, "I like it."
Mm.
I'm not. Necessarily.
I don't know. I mean, the great thing about comedy, and particularly in this country. Where I just think the comedy has always been very healthy in these aisles, and the great thing is it's something for everyone, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is totally a personal thing. You know, one person's five stars, another one's no stars.
when you talk about seeing Noel James and that sense of the momentum building up, that you said that you could, it's almost like if you're making them laugh anyway, you can get away with putting the dafties in. That was kind of the beginning.
Yeah, and I've
of
often
it.
Thought that about the way I structure my act sometimes, in that I once in a while I write something that is an absolute banker, and you know, and I thank God when those moments happen. But then there's lots of stuff that. It's not stuff you have to drop, it's nothing at all. But then there's also stuff you think, well, if I spread out the bankers across here and I put sure. a few in the slipstream here, yeah. you know, there's a lot of the spacing is kind of, it's very modular, my act. There's no story. Yeah. So I can look at it in terms of, if I think, oh, I just begin to run out of gas there, perhaps I'll sing a little song there, or I'll do a prop there, and I'll move okay. out there, and you know.
Because that thing about running out of gas, or like maintaining the momentum, is incredibly important, isn't it? It's something like, I've never seen Ken Dodd live, but I've seen some videos of his work. And the way that he kind of gets an audience, he sort of tickles an audience up, and then once they're up there, it's about keeping the ball in the air. Do you think
totally.
That's true of your work?
I think it's true. I think it's true of all comics. If it is to do with some, even if it feels like an absolute barrage, there's still got to be some sort of light and shade, if you, for want of a slightly pretentious phrase, but as in.
I like it when my guests are pretentious. if that's the terms you see it in, then that's what.
Well, I just mean that you, it's not so much. I like the idea of it being an onslaught. Don't get me wrong. I like the idea of going on and go bang, and if they laugh all the way, that's great. But I think it's when you tour and you're doing an hour, then you do have to think about it. Just have to change slightly. If I literally just stood there and did one line as bang 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 for an hour, and I have done that before, but I wouldn't want to do it on tour, it would kill me. So I have to put some things in to make things, you know, like chuck a pen behind my ear or sing a song.
Well, I wanted to talk about pen behind the ear, because I think it's one of the greatest comic inventions of our time. I genuinely do. For anyone that doesn't know it, can you just explain what that routine is?
It's purely thinking time when I'm on stage. I basically have a box of pens and I try and catch one behind my ear, but sort of spin it and land on my ear. But those
whilst the soundtrack plays.
Whilst the soundtrack's
going pen behind the ear. If you're having trouble visualising that, it's exactly what it sounds like, except that it's incredible. Because you frequently, now, this is the question I can't let you get away without answering.
Yeah.
Do you deliberately miss the first few so that you can get the mileage out of it?
Well, sort of, yeah. I don't try really hard until the music's been going for a little bit. But unfortunately, only the other night I did some a show in doing 20 minutes at the Assembly, and I thought I'd end with Pen Behind the Ear. And when I started really trying, I then found it wasn't landing. And so as a result, I went around the music, I think about six times. I think my record's eight times, but I went around quite a lot.
How long is the music? If you've been around it eight times, how long is the track?
Well, it's about 40 seconds, 45 seconds. It is quite long to be doing that.
Sure.
But I've never, ever not done it. So what I do is I just think, well, okay, I'm just going to stay here. So I've never, ever... No.
The mounting tension of that moment, it reminds me.
Of course,
me.
When you actually get it, the cheer, that's the thing. The one thing you have got to look forward to is that if you go around a lot of times, once it lands, it's a big cheer.
They're going
to
go absolutely bananas. I'll say something pretentious now. It reminds me of a classic French vaudeville act called Les Cent Assiettes, or the 100 Plates, where there's two performers and they've got a stack of 100 plates, and one of them goes, and then smashes it over his friend's head, and then, duh. And then they just smash 100 plates over this guy's head.
Wow.
I've got 400 plates at my house, but they're too heavy, so I think they'd kill someone
to try doing it.
But the way that it works, the way that I've heard that act works, is that it's funny because it's ludicrous, and then it's not funny, and then it's funny again, and then it's really not funny, and they hate you, and then it's hilarious with the plate smashing. Yeah. So you find that it looks to me like you're sort of playing the rhythm.
As hate, but yeah. But no, I think what I do think happens is that people who haven't seen it before wonder whether this is something I can actually do, and so perhaps they go, well, you know. So I think they think, well, why are you doing this?
But they're not just all sat there thinking, why are you doing this? Because it's very funny. It's a really funny bit.
Yes, but like you say, although it may not go as far as hate, I've never spoken this long about Pen Behind the Ear for tickets, even with my friends. And we have spoken about it. But I think that it gets to a point where people do think, if you take it to just three or four times around the music, then there is an element of, oh, come on.
Yeah.
And then it's, the best ones are when they're close.
They get more involved and the room goes, whoa.
The risk is that the close ones, I can't go for the close ones too early in case they land accidentally.
Okay.
So I'll go for them later.
So you were saying you refer to that as an item.
Yes, I have. When I write an hour or something, I have items, and I have props, and I have one-liners and songs.
Okay, and you sprinkle
and
them.
And I try and go just about moving between those areas.
Sure.
And okay. I think they're getting sick of one area, I move to another one. And in fact, they're all
so
really
that
just
so
jokes.
The structure of it allows you to change whenever you want.
I will find out by doing shows what okay. is the optimum place okay. for them. I don't tend to change. The only thing that does change sometimes is the props change a little bit sometimes, and I do that as regarding, you know, I think myself, I better go and pick something up. I can feel them just going.
Sure.
Slightly, you know.
When we did the tartan ribbon benefit the other night, yes. me and David O'Doherty, he was waiting to go on after you, and I was comparing, and we were discussing whether or not your songs, the little snatches of songs that come in that you sing ridiculous songs to, sort of songs about the nature of songs or waiting, you know, waiting to have fun, stuff like that. He was speculating as to whether you know which music cue is going to get played next. Or whether it's just play one on the track and I'll sing whichever song comes.
Well, actually, on that particular night, I didn't know what was coming next.
Okay.
I said to the Jobbins, I gave him the CD and I said,
name.
I'm going to go this one, this one, this one, and this one. But I may do the last two in a different order. And so he went up there and I just... And the cue is always... I try and keep it simple when I go on tour. Because if I go on tour, I have to use a different sound person in each venue. So you've got to make sure that everyone's first go at it. So I always say to people, the cue is, hit the music, please. That's what I say each time. And that's it. So literally, every time I go, hit the music, please, and the thing starts. And one time on that night, I do remember thinking, I don't know what's next, but...
Sure.
There
okay.
was enough of music that, as it started, I then
that it can help you out. Okay. One of the other items I wanted to mention was the multiple puppets.
Yes.
When you take a puppet and then you explain that he has a puppet and then that he has a little puppet and then the little puppet gets another puppet.
The ventriloquism thing. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't quite know what my question is, other than I love that bit. where did that come from? Was that something you'd played with as a 10-year-old puppeteer?
Well, I just remember writing it because sometimes when I write, I just will write lists of ideas. I'll write sort of 1 to 20, I think, right, I'll just write anything. And I think I just wrote a puppet with a puppet with a puppet.
Okay.
Something like that. Or ventriloquist with a ventriloquist with a ventriloquist.
So this is Tim. How good is this? You look for your voice, then you discover you're just supposed to talk like you normally talk. Love him. I'm loving this interview. And you should immediately, if you haven't already, immediately go to YouTube and look up Pen Behind the Ear. You're not allowed to listen to the rest of this interview until you've seen it. It's an essential part of your comedy heritage, I suppose, wherever you're from, your global comedy heritage, I've just decided. We'll bash on with the rest of this very soon. Just time to thank you once again for all of your donations. Do chip in if you feel like you'd like to support the show, if you think it's made a difference to your career or your life or your weird, anxious mind. You can make a donation of any size at comedianscomedian.com. Just click on the PayPal button. Thank you to everyone who's donated so far. I'm so, so grateful. Thank you very much. Exciting news for next time. The brilliant Kerry Godleyman is joining me later this week. And that'll be with you as soon as I get it done and Nathan kindly edits it for me. I can't wait to talk to Kerry. You'll know her from Ricky Gervais's Derek and also her own brilliant stand-up. She's a great comedy actress, a brilliant comic. Very much looking forward to that. Just one little extra thing before we go back into Tim. That sounds a bit weird, back into Tim, nonetheless. You can go to comedysnapshot.com and have a look at a brilliant book of backstage photos and portraits from a wonderful physical comedian called Steve Best. He's done a book of a photo and sort of interview project he's been doing. It's comedysnapshot.com. I'm in the book, as are loads and loads and loads of brilliant acts. I never remember to take pictures in dressing rooms myself, and whenever I see a decent dressing room photo, I'm always gutted that I haven't been doing it all along. If you're a newer act, take pictures in dressing rooms. It's so nice to look back and see a little slice of time stolen backstage like that. That's something I really regret not doing myself. Fortunately, comedysnapshot.com, Steve Best has been on it for all of us, really, with quotes from acts about their work and their lives alongside their pictures. I will get Steve on the show before long, I'm sure. He's a brilliant, brilliant comic. So go and check out his book. Blogger Becca Moody has said some lovely things about this show. Thank you, Becca. That's very kind of you. You can read her blog at moodycomedy.wordpress.com. Check that out. And that's it for now. Remember, you can watch video highlights of this and loads of other episodes at youtube.com/comcompod. And sticking one of those little video highlight links on someone's Facebook wall is a really good way of letting them know about the show. You can just keep it yourself if you'd prefer. Why should those bastards get all the good stuff? Hang on to it, mate. Don't tell a soul. Now, let's get back to Tim Vine.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
You like to watch new stuff, right? Well, go to Hulu and see what's new, because Hulu has new stuff all the time. Like Vanderpump Villa, the new docudrama starring Lisa Vanderpump, where first-class luxury meets world-class drama. A new season of The Kardashians, starring The Kardashians, of course. And Grand Cayman, Secrets in Paradise, the sizzling new reality show set in the tropical Caribbean. It's all new, and it's streaming now on Hulu.
Let's talk about the writing then. So when you say, when I sit and write, are you, what does your writing week look like? Do you have sort of a structure to how you...
I've never had a writing week.
Everyone laughs at that, don't worry.
I've got to have an office to avoid an anything week. What tends to happen is stuff can happen conversationally with mates. So sometimes jokes come up like that. Someone will say something and I'll go, oh, that's a good idea.
Sure.
And maybe, so then I scribble a few. I normally have a piece of paper or something with me, and I might scribble the odd idea down or text it to myself or something. I've got a very old phone. when I've got to get ready for a tour, then I might actually, then I do sit down and deliberately, I might occasionally I'll go to a library and do a day there or something, you know.
Okay. Okay, that's incredible. Given that you produce an enormous volume of material.
And I use it all. Don't drop any of it.
But given that, I'm surprised to hear, I think I probably anticipated you'd be more kind of, you'd be one of the disciplined guys of going, okay, well, I get up in the morning and I write for 4 hours. And
well, no, I can be quite disciplined. The thing that makes me feel disciplined is a deadline. So if my promoter has convinced me to put a tour in, you know, in a 9 months hence.
Is that the way around it works? Your promoter convinces you to put a tour in?
Well, occasionally he'll ring up and say... You've got to do it for the fans. And I say, have those three been on the line again? You know, but yes is a very small word, but it opens up a whole... Once you can't just say yes to get them off the phone, because once you've said yes, you've got to write an hour, you know.
Yeah.
So, but when that happens, and you know that he's then filling up all these venues, you know, in a few months' time, that does then make you, then that makes you write. There's a fear of having nothing. So then I would, in that situation, and I've occasionally seen things written that say, oh, Tim Vine writes 15 jokes a day or something.
Sure.
As though that's my normal thing that I go around writing. And that, it was just a period leading up to a tour where I thought, right, I'll write 15 jokes every day.
Okay.
And I can get that done in, you know, in an hour or something.
Okay.
And then have the rest of the day
and
free.
What sort of, apart from the notes... Apart from the notes that you've got in your back pocket from previous conversations, do you have any other methods of kind of finding starting points? Are you kind of flicking through books, finding random words to play with?
Occasionally you use a newspaper, but not that often really use a newspaper. What I kind of do is, it's more that I will write one to ten on a piece of, on a postcard. I tend to write on postcards.
Okay.
I'm always buying, you know, those free postcards you get in pubs.
Yeah.
I'm always getting them because I think to myself, oh, great. So I've got loads and loads of postcards.
What's the thinking behind that? Why a postcard? Just because there's 10 things and it's done and they fit.
I think it's when you try things out, you read things. You don't learn things when you go and try it. You don't learn it all.
Okay.
So if I go to a new material place to try out material,
sure,
I'd take these postcards.
You've already
written,
that's the written form of it, is ready to go on the stage.
Yeah, okay. Kind of, yeah. I might write on another postcard actually to make it a bit neater, but yeah, I don't know why I stick on postcards. Okay. But to me, I say to myself, I'll do the quantity, and then the quality sorts itself out. So I'll write 10 jokes, and I don't worry about the quality. I don't, you know, think to myself. I remember a friend of mine, who was a very new comic, and she rang me up and said, oh, I've been trying to get this joke, and she said she'd been staring at a piece of paper for like 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to get this perfect form, no one can work like that. I said, forget that. Just write 10 jokes and don't try and write one. Write just 10 quite quickly, and then go and do something else.
Okay.
Otherwise,
yeah,
it's, I mean,
that's
you
really
can't,
good
you're
advice.
Staring. The main thing is to let yourself write rubbish. That's what with me anyway. I let myself write nonsense. It's a bit like when you get you know, when you get 4-year-olds walking around trying to be funny, and they'll say, "Oh, this, that, and the other, da-da-da, oh, you're a smelly pants," and da-da-da. And they just talk rubbish. Every now and again, they'll say something, and everyone absolutely roars with laughter.
Okay.
Because the valve is open with them that says, sure. it doesn't matter about making a fool of yourself socially.
Yeah.
You could just say something. So, okay. You know, if you're happy about making a fool of yourself, there's a whole world of fun the other side of it.
Okay. So do you have any kind of, when you take a joke or a word or a concept, do you have any sort of familiar habits of how you try and find the funny in it?
Well, yes, I probably do. And some of them I'm trying to get out of, actually, to be honest, because although I'm known for the whole pun thing, and I kind of play up to it a bit, because it's quite nice if you have a thing, you know, and apparently if that's my thing, I'm happy if that's been my thing. But I do look at words and you know, quite literally look at, you know, I'm trying to think of examples of playing on word type things, but here's an example of a joke that is not a wordplay joke, which is, this is one of my jokes where I say, I saw quite a rare thing the other day. I saw a toucan in my garden. That's quite rare, isn't it? See a toucan in your garden. Then I got a bit closer. I realised it wasn't a toucan. It was a magpie eating a banana. Now, I'd like to write more of that sort of thing.
Yes, I see. Okay. Because it's a visual picture rather than a linguistic trick.
Yeah, because that's where some of the... I don't know, I just like that sort of thing. It strikes me as being a bit cleverer than Velcro, what a rip-off. I don't know, but I do like that
stuff. Bastards, you're making him do that stuff.
Yeah. But I do like that sort of thing, but I just... I suppose what it is that I... Believe it or not, with my act, I hate groaning. I absolutely hate it, and it's a good job too. Otherwise, if I was aiming for groaning, I could nail that.
Yeah,
you could write an hour in a couple of days, couldn't you? And the less likely to groan at stuff that's like that toucan one, they might not find it funny, but there's less groan. So I want to do more of that sort of thing. I have one where I say, do you know, if you chop a horse in half, then bang the two halves together, it sounds like someone riding a coconut. Yeah. It's kind of more like twisted logic jokes.
Yes, yes.
You know, which people like Milton Jones are geniuses at writing that sort of thing. Although he has his fair share of the kind of pure pun as well.
Sure.
But that's kind of, I'd like to mix it up a bit, but I'd like to have more of that sort of thing.
Okay. Okay.
At this point in my life, I'd like to write more of that, or maybe forget the whole thing.
Yeah. Do you think, coming just to hold with the idea of the puns, because I suppose having been to numerous Edinburgh festivals and seen your posters, which describe you as the pun slinger and a pun smith, you know, and you know, obviously as a kind of marketing strategy, or like you say, it's good to have a thing that people can connect with you. I'd anticipated you doing a lot more puns than you did. And then when I came and sat and watched one of your videos and when I saw your chat show, I did notice more and more of those jokes, the twisted logic ones. The one like,
I went to a travel agent. I said, I want to book a flight, very short notice. So you see, you've just missed it.
Yeah, I'd like, that's lovely. And I agree that they seem... Or do they? Do they to you? Do they seem better jokes? Do they seem more whole somehow because they're more surprising? Less likely
they do slightly seem more. They seem maybe cleverer in a way, but also. But then equally, you know, if I say I went on a date with a girl called Simile, I don't know what a metaphor that's a pun. That used to get a big one. So, and also going back to what Noel James. I should be talking over the laugh. Come on, guys. Going back to the Noel James experience, to have someone saying, you know, I saw someone going bald. He was going bald. Yeah. It's just silly, and I do like silly.
Yes.
So
sure.
So I don't. You know, I want to. You know, probably the aim of most comics is to be as funny doing as little as possible.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Tommy Cooper used to breathe out when everyone fell over, didn't he?
So when you're on stage, when you're performing, you have a particular type of persona, and you've just kind of gone into it a couple of times there when you've got that kind of, you know, that I don't know how to quite do it for the sake of the recording, but it's a, you know what I mean, it's a tone of voice that's kind of a sort of showman music hall, can't stay with me kind of,
yeah,
that little burst of energy. Let's talk about that
enthusiasm.
But it's not just enthusiasm, it's a kind of slightly cheesy sort of you're putting,
although
it,
I never, I must admit, cheesy's not, I'm not a big fan of cheesy unless it's describing something made of cheese, because so many things that people say are cheesy, I really like. So I don't quite understand what... it's a word like corny as well. Sometimes I don't quite understand corny or schmaltzy. I really like over-sentimentality in films. And I like things that people think are cheesy and
Okay. Corey. I don't mean to use the word negatively.
My tone suddenly was like, what are you doing? Yeah.
No, do that. Stand up, kick table over.
But I know what you mean by saying that's the sort of
there is a sort of there is a style.
It's almost sort of too enthusiastic, isn't it?
There we go. So that style. When you started doing stand up, when did that kind of creep in?
Well, I discovered doing the sort of thing I was doing, it's best to do it at speed. and grit your teeth. And I think it was fronting it out as well. And that is something that you do. Learn a bit as you know, literally over a few years, I think, of doing stand up is that particularly with silly stuff, you must front it out. It's no good saying it, and then that's why I don't like groaning. Groaning is like an apology, you know.
Yes,
or,
okay.
Another one of my pet hates is badumch. I'm not a big fan of that at all, because that's all those are in the place where the laugh should be,
yes,
you know. So, okay. I don't know, I just feel like. When you, I've done it again. I've started. And I've
no. You're on it. You're on it. Keep going. You've forgotten it. So we're talking about the cell. That moment when you sell it, when you front it.
I got very excited. So I just think that I'll say the Velcro, what a rip-off joke. If I were to do that very deadpan, Velcro, what a rip-off. I mean, maybe it's probably still funny, but there's something. I think there's something, just generally about doing things on the up. You know, Velcro, what a rip-off. You know.
Yeah. I mean, there is something.
Sometimes I've occasionally said to people when they've asked me about radio shows, I've said I'm not a big fan of doing radio because I can't use my eyebrows.
Yes, I was just going to say after you said it just then, you went Velcro, what a rip off! And there's a little moment, there's a little half a second where you almost have like a little.
It's slightly knowing, probably.
Yes, I think that's what it is. It sort of frames it in a kind of a look. I know this is stupid.
Yeah, yeah.
You're kind of selling it. There's another element to how you're selling it.
Yeah, and a lot of my. I mean, I'm certainly not the first person to do that. A lot of my comedy heroes, that is a kind of comedy device. He's not particularly in vogue anymore, but I really like Benny Hill, for example. Now, Benny Hill used to constantly do that thing where he'd say something and then he'd do a little smirk at the end of it. Now, he's put that smirk in. That's not him about to corpse, but it's a lovely, it has a lot of charm, you know. And, you know, a lot of these people like Tommy Cooper and Les Dawson, they'd give you a little look that says, you know, I know what's going on here.
Yeah. There's something else about the way you...
It sounds
you,
terrible to say that, doesn't it? But yeah.
No, well, why would you think that sounds terrible? Do you feel that's kind of giving away the magic of it?
Not giving away, but it's just suddenly you realise that actually it's all fakery, isn't it? The whole thing's fakery. But I mean, but it is, isn't it? It's a performance.
Sure.
So if someone comes and sees you on stage and some of the bits that look slightly ad-libby, some of them are, but then some of them aren't, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I suppose that's showbiz, isn't it? Nonsense, isn't it, from start to finish?
There's something, funnily enough, when you said that, your body changed a little bit then, when you kind of said, God, it's all sort of fakery, is it really? Do you feel that there's an element of it
ashamed of?
Well, no, I didn't say that. That it's. Yeah. Do you feel there's an element by which it's kind of a shame that it's an act?
No, because we all know when we go and see people. And also, and I know Benny Hills is an act, but I watch him and I love it, you know. So we all know it's an act. But when you're the one doing the act, sometimes you do feel like a bit of an idiot. But because it is what it is. You're getting up there and making out you've got something to say. I really haven't got anything to say. I've just got some jokes.
Okay. Is that because you love what's silly, is that kind of part of the payment for getting to do stuff that's silly, is that every so often you have to kind of go, God, this is all a bit silly?
Well, I don't tend to go, God, it's all a bit silly during my act, but, I don't know. I like being silly. I mean, it's funny, people have sometimes said to me, oh, you know, how do you, you know, is it tiring being funny all the time? People expect you to be funny all the time. I think it's a slightly strange question because actually that's socially the way we all want to be anyway. When you're with your friends, you want to make your friends laugh and you want them to make you laugh. That's our sort of relaxed default position, isn't it?
Sure.
That's not a position of high tension. That's the idea of having fun.
Yeah. Sure, but then you're performing in a state where it's necessary that you make people laugh.
Yeah, I'm not like that socially. I'm not kind of. That's the other thing people ask me occasionally is whether or not I'm really... I wouldn't want to be in your head, they say, as though, doing all these thousands of jokes, I literally walk off stage and continue.
Yeah.
So instead of a taxi driver, it's not like that, you know.
Sure. Do you, and do you, when you walk off stage, I mean, it must be exhausting keeping up the level of
performance. Yeah, I get asked that question a lot as well. I mean, I find it invigorating. Sometimes I go on. Sometimes I'm tired before I go on. And then when I get off, I feel it's giving me energy. Because touring can be quite tiring. Touring can be tiring. That sounds nice. So sometimes I remember one tour, I was so tired that the person came in and said, you're on in 2 minutes. This is your 1 minute call. He didn't say that. He said, you're on in 2 minutes. And I actually thought to myself, I'm going to have a tiny bit of sleep. So I just had a little, I just closed my eyes and I actually went off for about a minute before going on.
Okay.
Completely, that's how tired I was before I go. But then when I went on, because the act has its own speed anyway, and you do the whole thing and you come off and you don't want to go to bed. You know.
Are there any elements to stand-up that you feel you'd like to be able to do more of? Is there anything that feels like the sort of intangible or out of your reach?
Well, I not that I feel I'd like to do more of. I do sometimes think to myself it would be fascinating to start again but adopt a totally different style.
Sure.
And do the whole chatty thing, you know, and be more myself, you know.
So do you? Where does that thought come from? Do you ever feel like you're kind of? But do you ever feel like you're sort of on a particular track now that you're? I don't want to say the word trapped, but do you know what I mean? You do a certain thing.
Yeah, people like, do expect you to do what you do, I suppose. Yeah. So in that sense, I've painted myself into a corner that if I do a tour, I've got to do hundreds of one-liners. But even then, that's not even the case, is it? If I want to do an hour of contemporary dance, I can do that, can I? No, people might not turn up. It'd be up to me, wouldn't it? You can do what you
Please
want.
Please come back to Edinburgh and do an hour of contemporary dance on the Free Fringe. But are there any other, like we were talking about sort of intangible things, you were to come back, if you were to start again and go, okay, I'll do conversational stuff, would you be wanting to do that so that you could express yourself? Where would that come from?
No, it wouldn't be for a sort of therapy thing. It would just be because I see some of these guys doing, I don't know, a lot of the people like, I don't know, like these people that I started with, like Alan Davis or Boothby Graffo, people who were, when I first came on the circuit, we're doing 20 minutes. I just really looked up to that sort of comedy. In the end, I've turned out to be doing something that I probably is maybe a simpler sort of comedy, isn't it? Just to do jokes, isn't it? It's a bit boring. But it's very, very skilled. I mean, I sort of keep mentioning Alan. He's probably not in the room anymore. But Alan Davis, it's so organic. I used to love watching him doing his stuff in a club. To be close to people like him and Eddie Izzard and watch that way, the conversational way, it would just really slowly start with, it was beautiful, you know. So I kind of probably aspired to be a bit like that when I started, then it ended up being jokes.
Okay. We've got about sort of 10-15 minutes left to go. I'd like to give you the opportunity to ask some questions of Tim, if that's all right. What normally happens is there's a bit of an eggy pause while I explain that, and you'll look at me. So I'm just telling
they're
you that
now. They're doing that now. They're doing it.
I'll ask another question, and then I'll come back to you if you've got a thing. What I was going to ask was, are you where you want to be as a comedian? Are you as successful as you want to be?
Well, I don't really think in terms of success. I think in terms of fun. Because I never got into this job in the first place to make money or be successful. I honestly, it was purely fun. And if ever that thing stopped being fun, and sometimes you get in situations where you're working something, you get surrounded. But the more successful you get, the more people that you find yourself in a situation where more people are taking it seriously and look at you in a way that it's not the same as what it was when I was in a comedy cafe with a scrap of paper about to go on and mess about with my mates, you know. So I always tell myself it's fun first and then everything else second, in which case I'm perfectly happy with the things that they are, yeah. And the way that it is at the moment, I can, you know, if I want to make a little film or something, I can go make a little film on it. I mean, I'd have to pay for it. No one would pay for it. But
sure.
But, you know, cameras are very easy to get hold of now. And you can do what you like, can't you, really?
Yeah. Okay.
In life.
We'll go to the audience. If anyone has a question for Tim, feel free to raise a hand. Okay, so how did you when you were dying in your early days, when you had a bad gig, how did you keep the faith with yourself and believe in yourself that you could go back and do it again?
Well, do you know what? I don't think it was even to do with having faith in myself. It was to do with how much I enjoyed doing the thing in the first place. And I think that is kind of what draws you back, is that if you've got this slight madness in it that you want to get up on stage, you know, getting up in front of people who shout you're rubbish over and over again is not enough to kill off that little dream in your heart to get back up again and make it work, you know. So it's not even to do with faith. It could be that And it does. I mean, it does hurt when you die, and you know, it's not nice, and particularly early on because you probably have your worst deaths. Actually, that's not true. I've had some horrific ones in recent years, corporates and things. But I remember when I first gave up my job in an office. I was working with Boothby Graffo, supporting Boothby on a tour of universities, and I was booed off at Woolwich University. I went on, and normally when it's going badly, I still do my time because I say to myself, well, I want to at least make sure they pay me. You know? And but this one, literally, there was no way of staying on. Something I did, whatever, it was, they just didn't like me. And with 3 minutes after going on, I'd walked off. And I was kind of really upset by this, and I felt like I was quite close to tears, actually. And I said to, I remember saying to Boothby, I'm not sure I can do this. And I always remember, and it's in a way a nice little metaphor for how you should deal with deaths. Boothby took a drag of his cigarette and just shrugged his shoulders like that. He said, it doesn't matter. I mean, it doesn't matter, really, to be honest.
Well, it doesn't matter that you died, or it doesn't matter that you're thinking of giving
none
up
of it matters.
If you
want to
give up.
Nothing matters.
It would be lovely to end the show there on that sentiment. We have got a bit more time.
What I took away from it was that. This isn't a great. The fact that these people hated you is not a great big statement on your act or the following gig or the gig before. It was just so. His reaction was so matter of the fact. It was as if to say, "Well, that's going to happen sometimes, you know. Get over it." He didn't come over and put his arm around me and say, "Oh, sorry, is it hurting?" Oh, he didn't do that. He just.
Yeah.
It was a perfect response to get from him because it was like, well, you know, it was like a man who'd been through that himself a lot of times, and you know.
I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I heard a story about Boothby saying that, like, his habit when newer acts died, he'd come and put his arm around their shoulder and he'd say, there's a worse one out there. Do you know what I mean? Just waiting for you, yeah.
Oh, yeah, well, no, he didn't do that. But, so I think the answer to your question is that, is that to come from a position of you've had a bad one, really, you don't know how to keep faith with it? It's how much you want to do it, really, at the end of the day. You know, it's... you will take it personally, but you shouldn't really take it personally. But you can't help it.
Any other questions? Given your natural style, would you do another situation comedy?
Yeah, I would do another one, I think, probably. My natural style, did you say? Yeah. Thank you. I thought when you started that, I thought you meant my natural style of joke telling. But did you mean my acting or something then, do you? Oh, right, okay, right. But yeah, no, I'm up for anything, really, for, you know, whatever.
Okay. Did you enjoy working on Not Going Out? Is that?
Yeah, I loved it, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I did 5 series of it, and I felt that I didn't really want to do it forever. I felt that 5 was probably enough. But yeah, no, it's great fun. And working with Lee is, I mean, Lee is, have you spoken to him on this?
No, not yet. No.
Oh, you should do. No, there's a hard worker.
Yeah, okay.
Now,
I think he was one of the first comics. Well, I got into comedy sort of through Alan Cochrane. He was the first comic I knew before I became one.
Right.
He's good mates with Lee. Mm. And I think through Alan's description of how hard Lee works, I probably thought all comedians have an office and write all day long.
And it turns out not.
But, no, almost
but
none of them.
No, he is very dedicated. He's married the two things up of being very good, but also working very hard. I mean, he literally does the amount of work he puts into Not Going Out, writing the scripts and stuff is incredible.
Who is your comedy hero and why?
Well, I probably can't nail it down to one, really, but let's take them in groups. All the dead ones. Some of the live ones. No. Well, there's the ones that were my heroes when I watched them as a child. So then it would be all, and it's probably very predictable, but all people like Morecambe Wise, Tommy Cooper, Les Dawson, Frankie Howard, I absolutely love.
Mm.
And Larry Grayson, massively underrated, who I think is absolutely hilarious. If you get the chance to watch any Larry Grayson stand-up, it's hilarious. So there's that. And then there's also, then when I started on the circuit, doing the comedy circuit, then if you ask me who my comedy heroes were then, they were all the people who I was watching doing 20 minutes while I was doing my 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So Kevin Day was another one who I remember, you know, he was established doing 20s, and you just I just thought this time of 20 minutes was something to be aiming for. And so the people who were doing 20 minutes were my kind of comedy heroes at the time, you know.
Okay, so who else apart from Kevin when you were
Lee Evans I worked with, I suppose, a couple of times. The Rubber Bishops, Eddie Izzard. Go on, name some people from that era. Alan Davies.
Okay.
Bob Mills.
Okay.
Just people that, their 20s. They were like.
You liked them because they were heroic to you because they were doing 20s.
Yes.
But what was it about their material? Were there particular people that you went, they've got it. That's the thing I should be looking for.
I honestly thought all of them at the time. Now I have some are more favourites than others now. But it's, I tell you the way I look at it, and I bumped into Owen O'Neill, who would have been another one who was on the circuit at the time, who's doing the Shawshank Redemption up here. And I said to him, we were in a group chatting, and I said, the funny thing is, when you're first doing your open spots, the people who are established on the circuit, they're a bit like sixth formers.
Yeah.
And you never get, that atmosphere never leaves. So when you meet those people again, you're always slightly, you know.
Sure.
So I
didn't realise that Alan was one of your sixth formers when you said hello to him in here earlier on.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. No, he was doing established 20s when I was doing my fives. Yeah.
Okay. So you've been coming up to Edinburgh for a long time. Are you planning to keep coming up here?
Well, I hope so.
Do you take years off? Or?
I've done it 11 times in about 20 years, so not every year. But no, I love it up here. In fact, one of the things that it reminds me of is the business of doing it for fun, you know, because you don't know what does it up here for money. But because I like the thing of being in the corner of the comedy cafe with a scrap of paper, that thing. There's a sense that the fringe feel to it I really like, you know. So I like being in a room like this where you can see the people really close to you and they're staring at you.
And are you happy?
I am, I think, yeah. I sort of gravitate towards happiness, I think. Yeah, I'll tell you what, that one came out of nowhere, that question, didn't it? We left that one till
don't
the
talk
end.
To them, look at me.
No, I am, yeah. I think I'm a bit like my dad in that, but my dad is really into maths. I'm not really into maths, but my dad, if you give him a pad of paper and a pen, he'll sit in a coffee shop with a cup of coffee and a Danish pastry and write maths equations. I'm a bit like that with jokes. My dad will go, "Oh, wonderful, sit here." And it's a terrible impression, but we all do the same thing. "Wonderful, Jim, wonderful. Sit here, lovely cup of coffee, sit in the garden and let's write some equations." Now, I have that slightly same, I think, hopefully, anyway, I aspire to be like my dad 24/7, to be honest, but that I do lean towards that approach to life, which is, do you know what, it's wonderful. I'm grateful for the job I've got, let's put it that way.
Great, so we'll do one more question and then we'll wind up. Was it a conscious decision to do clean comedy?
No, it wasn't really, no, but that partly comes, I think, from the fact, there's probably three things. One is that the comedians I knew from the past on television, it was all clean in those days anyway. Mm-hmm. And they were sort of my kind of early comedy heroes. Secondly, I wanted to do silly stuff. And silly stuff, I mean, look, someone like Harry Hill or someone else who was an inspiration to me when I was younger, I remember seeing up here setting his props before his show in 1993, I think it was, thinking, look at that, king of his own little world.
Yeah,
I want to be like that. But he does silly stuff, and so if you F and blind in the middle of it, it would be a bit odd.
Sure.
Then the third thing is, I don't think my mum and dad would like that, and I want them to like my act. Which sounds pathetic, but we want our parents to like us, don't we? I mean, they still like me, but I mean, I want them to not say, "I wasn't so keen on that bit, darling."
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Tim Vine.
Thank you.
Thanks, mate.
So that was Tim. Fun first, then everything else second. Love him. Just love him. He's properly got his head screwed on and just produces such an output of quality stuff of all sorts. Really, really do check out some of his stuff. The ventriloquism thing with all the puppets, ventriloquizing other puppets. He's just brilliant. What an imagination. Very, very inspiring. That is all for now from me. Speak to you next week. It'll be the first non-live one that we've had for a while, if we can get it edited in time. If not, then one of the very last three Ed Fringe ones. You'll have to wait and see. Thanks to Pete Jones and James Lowy. Thanks to Ben Lund Conlon and Sarah Grun for the Podmin. And this episode was co-produced by Nathan Wood. I've been Stuart Goldsmith. Speak to you soon.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.